Hello, Radioland. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv. I am your host, Graham Stinnett, and today we are talking about railroad collections. And specifically, we have a couple of guests in the studio today. Jack Swanberg, a donor and railroad aficionado, more or less, to talk about his collection at the archives, and my colleague Laura Smith, who oversees that collection as well as our other railroad collections. I'm going to pass the mic off for the majority of the episode today to Laura, but I'm going to quickly read an introduction for Jack, just to kind of get us a bit of context about Jack's experiences and his history. Jack Swanberg was born in 1939 in Norwalk, Connecticut, and grew up in Newtown. After graduating from Trinity College in 1961, he was hired by the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad, better known as the New Haven Railroad, as a locomotive fireman. In October 1962, Jack volunteered with the United States Navy in their Naval Aviation Division and commissioned as an ensign in February 1963. He received his navigator's wings in July 63 and was assigned to transport squadrons in California, flying mostly Pacific routes, including many missions into Vietnam. He left active duty in 1966, but stayed in the Naval Aviation Reserve for 25 more years, retiring as a Navy captain. After his military service, Jack truly began his professional career as a railroad man. In 1966, Jack returned to the New Haven Railroad, but became a management trainee for the New York Central Railroad in October 66. He served as an assistant trainmaster in Detroit when the New York Central Railroad was merged into the Penn Central in 1968. Then as a Penn Central assistant trainmaster in Brewster, New York, in 1969, and as a trainmaster in Grand Central Terminal in New York City in 1970. He held trainmaster positions for Penn Central, Conrail, and then Metro North Commuter Railroad in the 1970s and 1980s. When he retired from Metro North in January 2000, his position was lead trainmaster. Jack is an avid and accomplished photographer, and he began building his collection of photographs of trains and engines at a young age. While growing up in Connecticut, the focus was on the New Haven Railroad, which dominated railroad travel in southern New England from 1872 to 1968, and then its many successor railroad lines. But in his lifetime, he has literally traveled the world, photographing railroad trains and scenes. Jack's collection encompasses not just thousands of photographs he has personally taken, but also includes many collections of other prominent railroad photographers. His photographs have been widely published, many by other railroad history authors. Jack is the author of New Haven Power, 1838 to 1968, Steam, Diesel, Electric, MUs, Trolleys, Motor Cars, Buses, and Boats, A History of the Locomotives and Motive Equipment of the New Haven Railroad, published in 1988 and considered the definitive history of the New Haven Railroad's engines. He continues to write about railroads and edit others' writings. Several years ago, Jack deeded his collection to the Railroad History Archives at the Yukon Archives. The archives holds the corporate records of the New Haven Railroad and other collections of documents related to 200 years of railroad history in southern New England. Today, we will talk with Jack about his lifetime love of trains, his photographic collection, and his work with the Yukon Archives. So I'm going to pass the mic over to Laura Smith, who oversees the railroad collections, to proceed with the interview with Jack. And thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thank you, Graham. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be speaking with Jack, who, as this interview unfolds, you will see how he's been a true friend of the Yukon Archives, and you will learn about his extraordinary collection. So, Jack, thank you for being here. Tell us a bit about your early years as a boy and teen in Connecticut, especially about your early exposure to trains and how you started becoming a photographer of trains.
Well, before we lived in Newtown, we lived in Rowayton. And my dad commuted by train from Norwalk, and so I was like 3 years old, and Mom would throw my sister and myself into the car, take Dad to the station for his train to New York. And I was just bowled over the first time I saw a train. For some reason, it really attracted me. And as I say, I was only 3 years old, so I wasn't taking pictures by then, but there was just something about it that I really liked that train. And And most little boys like trains, but I just never outgrew that. So it's I wasn't taking pictures then. We moved to Newtown in 1948, and I started taking pictures when I was around 15 of trains, but I was attracted. There was a big freight line going through Newtown that went over to Maybrook, New York, with 100-car freights, and so I'd get over there on my bike and watch those things before I even had a camera. So it's just some attraction, like stamp collectors. Why do they collect stamps? So who knows? But it's just it grew on me. And when I went to Trinity, I was just a regular liberal arts major. But I looked at a railroad magazine, and there's a picture of a steam engine running in Mexico. And our railroads were all dieselized by then. So I went to my advisor and said, "Is there a Mexican exchange program?" Not telling him that I was just mainly interested in the trains. But he says, "No, but there's a University of Madrid has a junior year in Spain program." And I knew there were lots of steam engines in Spain, so I went to that. And the railroad really caused that, or my railroad interest, but it turned out to be the best thing I did in college. It was just a great education to be in Spain in general for a kid my age. And NYU ran the program, so I had U.S. credits. So I came back and went right back into my senior class at Trinity. So the railroad really meant quite a bit. And when we were looking around after boarding school, Dad was showing me around to various colleges in New England to decide where to go. And first I was interested in Amherst because the Central Vermont Railway went through there with steam engines. And I talked to the agent. Dad dropped me off at the station. I talked to the agent. He said, "Oh, no, we're going to dieselize in about a year." So I lost interest in that. I ended up going to Trinity, which it was diesel also, but much more interesting. And Trinity was a good school. I had no complaints about that.
So, Jack, I know that as a boy, and then when you were in Europe, when you were in Spain, you took a lot of excursions. You did a lot of traveling specifically to photograph trains. So can you tell us a bit about how you actively sought out steam engines and other train lines to photograph them?
Well, even in this country, there's a few railroads down south that still had steam locomotives in 1959, 1960. The coal-hauling railroads tried to stay with steam as long as they could because they burned what they hauled. So I would, two or three of us from Newtown, other kids my age, one of them had enough money to have a car. And we'd all split the cost of gas and motels and, say, drive up to Montreal where there were still steam engines. When on spring break or something like that, or drive down to Roanoke, Virginia, where the Norfolk and Western was still running coal trains with steam. And that's how we got around. And later on, I would, well, for instance, when I graduated from college and so on, then I started taking overseas trips again, and always went by train. And if there was some place where they were running steam, which they still were, for instance, in India and China, Mongolia, Australia, parts of Europe, and I kept chasing that until it finally went away. The last was Inner Mongolia about 2000. Now there's no mainline steam engines anywhere in the world. There's a few open pit coal mines in China that might have steam shunting engines, but because they have free coal, but and labor is cheap, but there's no regular steam service anywhere. On the other hand, you have some excursion lines like the Essex steam train here in Connecticut, and there are probably a dozen of those in this country. And the Union Pacific has restored a huge steam engine, which they run on road excursions. It's got four leading wheels, eight power wheels, eight war power wheels, and four trailing wheels. And that is a large locomotive. It's called articulated because the two sections can swivel for curves. That's the biggest steam engine. Well, it's by some standards, the biggest steam engine in the world. And it's certainly the biggest thing running today.
Your interest isn't just in steam trains, steam engines. It's you've taken plenty of photographs of diesel and electric trains as well. So So how did you choose where you were going to travel to take your photos?
Well, as I say, when there was still steam around, I would go someplace where there were still running steam locomotives. And lately, since there aren't any steam locomotives, I'll just go where it's a nice place to travel. And one of the nice ways to do it is to ride these privately operated tour trains that are like a rolling hotel. You have your own suite with your own bathroom and shower and everything. And it's just like a hotel on wheels. And then a fancy dining car, fancy lounge car. And like in southern India, I took one 3 years ago. It's the last one before the COVID that I could take. And for instance, they'll pull into Bombay, and then the train waits for you. You tour the city and so on. It's your own train, so there's it waits while you're doing that. And you don't have to transfer bags to hotels and all that stuff. That is your hotel. And I've taken those in Sicily, Budapest, all over the place, all around the world, in Australia. Plus, as I say, India, China, and just about, you name it. And Africa also, there's a good private train operator out of Pretoria. Went over to Namibia with that. And they're all really luxury operations. On the other hand, you can ride these railroad buff trips. Those private trains are tourist trains. They're not really meant for railroad buffs. I mean, a railroad buff enjoys it, but they don't do anything for a railroad fan. But there are ones that do, and they'll like make day excursions with a steam engine, and then everybody gets out, and they back the train up, it comes roaring by you for photos, and comes back and picks you up and so on. Those are completely different. They're not luxury at all, but they're for the photos.
Now, you began your professional career after your military service, and you had mostly train master positions. Could you tell us, what is a train master? What kind of work did you do for the various railroads that you worked for?
Well, the train master is in charge of engine and train crews and in charge of yard masters. Each big yard has a yard master, a union yard master on duty, usually three shifts a day, telling the crews each move to make. In other words, switch out this track, service this industry, and so on. And I would be over them and also over the crews. And the other thing, for instance, if you have these industries like in Detroit, we had General Motors and Chrysler and so on. If you didn't get them switched on time, they'd call the president of the railroad. And the president would listen to them, and you'd hear about that. So you had to really, really watch your stuff with those. And the other thing is, if you have a derailment, grade crossing fatality, anything like that, you had to go to that and rectify it, attempt to rectify it. And a personal injury, of course, the first thing you do is get the person to the hospital. And there's just no end of things that a train master has to, anything goes wrong, it's my fault. And I have to straighten it out. So it's not a boring job.
Jack, in the 1980s, you started writing your history of the New Haven Railroad engines. Can you tell us about how you conducted that research, how you found the photos, how you gathered the information, the research that you did for that book?
Well, I had been collecting and taking photos since I was around 15 or so. And I whenever I could buy photos of New Haven, mainly New Haven, but also New York Central and so on, I would buy photos or whole collections. And I had a very good friend in Watertown, Connecticut, the late Harry Stearns, who had a huge collection of prints. And I used to visit him all the time. And unfortunately, he passed away years ago. So I bought his whole collection from his widow. And that's probably the biggest collection I have, except another friend of mine named Harold Goldsmith, who had a lot of photos in the New Haven book. Died young, unfortunately, and he willed me his whole New Haven collection. And then, while working on the book, I would interview people all over New England, old guys that are by the age I am now, that worked on steam engines and worked on early diesels and so on. And a lot of times I would buy photos from them, but mainly it was just great to get all their experiences, that they had worked on these engines since back at the turn of the century, back in 1900. and they remembered all that stuff. And it's just so great that I was able to talk to them. It was before recording, so I didn't record him, but I wrote everything down. And all that information would have been lost once they died. But this really helped to save it. So and that was a great part of the book. Like one of the fellows, he was an official on the New Haven at the Reedville Steam Locomotive Repair Shop. He knew more about steam engines than just about anybody I ever ran into. And I dedicated the whole steam chapter of the book to him. Arthur Bixby was, and he was so helpful. And so many of them were so helpful. And then the woman named Alice Ramsdell, her father started taking pictures back in the 1890s, and he was gone, but she had all the pictures. And she was a very suspicious type. And when I first went up there to East Thompson, where she lived, in this old farmhouse full of antiques, she was really wary because I think people had tried to rip her off. And she loaned me a couple of prints. And I went home and had copy negatives made, and then went back. And East Thompson's quite a ways from New Haven, where I live. Went back, and also a friend of mine said, bring donuts. So I brought, every time I bring a box of glazed donuts, and I started bringing the photos back. Pretty soon she trusted me, and she started loaning me a few negatives. And I had my own darkroom at that time, so I could print them up, and I could bring them back, give her a spare print. And then we really became fast friends, and she would loan me everything in the house because then she did trust me, and we were good friends. She's gone now, but stuff like that, it never would have happened if it hadn't been for the book. And now it's been, when I'm gone, that book is still there, and so it's preserved forever. The book went through three printings, but it's out of print now, but you could still get it online, but the information is there.
Now, when you did your research, I mean, it wasn't just photos, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of photos in the book, but the detail of information about the trains that you provided really is now considered the guide to these engines. Now, how did you find that textual information, the details about the history of the trains?
Well, part of it is, like, there's a magazine called Railway Age, which is still out there. It's the industry magazine. But if you get 1910 copies and so on, you can get a lot of information there. And there's a lot of there's a lot of books on the railroad. Although there was no complete New Haven book before mine. There have been quite a few since, but there wasn't really any New Haven book. But there's a lot of papers and stuff that I had collected since I first started in my teens, and I just had enough of that I could put together all these things, plus the interviews with these knowledgeable people. But you couldn't go online then. It wasn't there. You couldn't try and find information online. So you had to do it by hand. And then the other thing is there were no word processors or desktop computers or anything. The whole thing was typed up by myself. And you'd type up a draft of a chapter, then you'd look and say, well, I really should say that a little differently. You'd have to type another whole draft. It's not like your computer, you just press delete and put in something else in. I would have been able to do that book probably in half the time if I'd had a computer back then, but they didn't exist. So it was a different world. And certain pages will have a roster of locomotives, a list of steam locomotives, the size of the driving wheels, the date built, numbers, class, all that. And I got an IBM executive typewriter, which looks like printed page. It's got proportional type, doesn't look like typewriter type. And I did all the rosters myself on that. And that just took forever. And then the publisher just photographed them. They didn't have to set the type, and setting type for all that roster would have driven them crazy. There would have been mistakes. This way, I knew it was fine. And yet you look at the book, you think it was printed. So stuff like that takes a lot of time. I never had a kid. That book is my kid.
So Jack, let's talk about your collection. I've seen the collection. You have it all stored at your home. It is comprised of photographic prints, negatives, slides, These are all the images that you've taken through your 83-year-old lifetime, and the collections of other photographers. So, tell me how you keep this all organized, how you keep track of it, because my experience with you is that when you need to retrieve a certain image, you know exactly where to go. You have it all organized really well.
Well, a lot of it's just memory, because, for instance, the color slides are in chronological order. So they're not in alphabetical order by railroad or anything like that. So I just remember that I took something of the Southern Pacific in San Francisco back in 1964, and I know about where to look for it. Somebody else, though, would have a problem with that, and I don't know if UConn is going to try and classify those slides so that, say, a researcher can find the Southern Pacific in 64 or not. I mean, I could find it by memory. And then for the black and whites, same thing, but the black and whites, of course, you have negatives. And I have this elaborate numbering system and lettering system so I can find a negative for any print. And I used to print them up, but when my present house, I don't have a darkroom. So there's still a few Photoshops left. Most of them are gone, but there's one in Old Saybrook. And nobody uses a darkroom anymore. They just scan them. But they can scan a negative and make a decent print out of it. So that UConn could figure that out, because every print has a negative number on the back. And a UConn researcher could find it just as easily as me. Not so much the slides. The slides are labeled. You label them 35-millimeter slides. Every mount is labeled when, where, and so on. So that's no problem. The boxes are labeled with the general information for those 36 slides. So you can find them, but sometimes it's a needle in a haystack if you're looking for something, because I traveled around so much. When I was in California, I'd be up in Alaska on a flight for the Navy. I'd be taking pictures there. Then I'd be over in Japan with the Navy. I'd get leave in Japan and take pictures there. And finding all these, I mean, I could do it because I did it, but somebody that hasn't done it, it's going to be a challenge.
As an archivist, you know, I can say that we often will receive a collection of photographs, and none of the photos are identified. They're in a disheveled order. You know, we have ways to, you know, organize it and make it so researchers know how to navigate through it. So I have every confidence that when we do receive your collection, we will be able to have it organized as much as possible. So I want to talk now about when you and I met. So, Jack, I started my job in 1999, and you and I met in 2000. We met at a railroad conference, and we had coffee together. And I asked you, would you consider coming up to UConn and helping me identify photos in the collection? You know, I just said that there are plenty of photos that don't have any kind of description, and I knew that someone with your detailed memory of trains and your meticulous research, you would likely be able to identify scenes and trains and engines, certainly those that are of the New Haven Railroad. So you started visiting UConn a few times a year. You would come up to the archives, and I would present to you a collection, and you would start identifying the photos. We would notate, you know, what your descriptions of the photos. And I just want to make it clear that kind of information adds such value to the photographs. You know, it's one thing to look at a photo of a railroad train, but if you don't know what the railroad is, what year it is, where the location was, any kind of background to it, its research value is greatly diminished. So the work that you did in helping us identify photos that were already in the collection was just incredibly valuable to us. I also want to say that you worked with me often when I did a railroad exhibit. A lot of times I needed like additional descriptive information for captions when I was exhibiting photos, and you provided that. You often would loan me photos from your own collection for me to place in an exhibit. When we started doing digital collections, you provided descriptions for those photos as well. So, you know, I'm just saying this. This is the beginning of Jack's like relationship with the Yukon Archives, and how he became a great friend of the archives by sharing his expertise on railroad trains, not just New Haven, but just U.S. trains, international trains, and railroads. And he's helped me with reference questions. Jack has just always been there as a support to me for when I am working with the collections and helping others navigate through the collections. So let's talk about when we asked you to donate your collection, which was about 10, 12 years ago. So what were your thoughts on that? You know, you and I have joked that probably in your railroad career, you probably never thought that you would be working so closely with an archives. So when we started talking with you about donating your collection to the University of Connecticut, to the Railroad History Archives, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I had no problem with that as long as I keep it while I'm still around. In other words, I have this huge collection, and I know where stuff is. And if I'm still writing articles for various magazines. I just wrote the one book. One book was enough. That was so much work. But I write articles all the time for these various, mainly railroad magazines, and I need the collection for that. And it could be not just New Haven. It could be somebody wants something in Manchuria and so on. And I know where to go for it. So I didn't want UConn to have it now because then I couldn't use it for these articles, which I'm still writing. But it's in my will that everything, all the paper, all the photos, and there's a lot of paper, too, a lot of research paper on the New Haven Railroad. Every locomotive class has super detailed papers on it. All that goes to UConn when I keel over. But right now I'm still using it. But I've really enjoyed working with Laura and identifying these things, and so I just wish stores were a little closer to New Haven. Now it's when the COVID came. Of course, then I couldn't come up here. She couldn't come down to my place. Nobody could do anything. We worked out a way to do it by email, and the university has scanned thousands of my negatives, but the negative envelopes just had general data for 12 negatives, say, so Laura needed caption data for each individual photo, which we used to do. Either she would visit me or I would visit here, and we'd do it negative by negative. Well, in the COVID, we had to stop that, so we worked out. Laura devised a way to do it so she could email me the image, and then I would email back, say, 8 or 10 negatives a batch. I would email caption data, which I'm still doing, for each individual image, and that's ongoing. And they borrowed those negatives, scanned them, and then I have them back, so I can still use them for articles. But they'll get them all eventually. But once they have a scan, they don't really need the negative that much. But on the other hand, 50 years from now, that scan might be obsolete. The whole system could be obsolete in 50 years. It might go to something else that we can't even conceive of now. So you have to keep the original negatives. So if for some reason you should have to rescan them, you've got them. Especially black and whites, they don't fade. You look at your 1890s glass plate negatives, they're beautiful. They look like you took them yesterday. And I have a bunch of those, and they're going to be a challenge for UConn to store because some of those are 8x10 glass plates, very fragile and so on, but beautiful images. They're sharper than some of the stuff you see today. So it's the technology keeps changing, but they'll have all the original images. So if technology becomes obsolete, it'd be a challenge, but you could start over. And the other thing I did with the captions is we have student interns here, as you know, who help with the library. And They'll get an inbound collection of photos that, as Laura says, are not labeled or anything, and I can help them out. They're not railroad buffs, but I can help them out and say, well, this is a steam locomotive, this is a diesel locomotive, NYC means New York Central, and so on, to get them started, because I don't have time to go through every inbound collection myself, but this way it gives the interns a way to do it.
So I want to make something clear that Jack's collection is currently still in his own home. The agreement that we have made with Jack is that he has signed a deed of gift. After his death, all of the photographs will physically be transferred to the University of Connecticut Archives. Jack and I are working on a project now where he gives me batches of his photos. We scan them in the archive or in the library's digital capture lab. And I am placing these images in the digital repository, the Connecticut Digital Archive. You will find several thousands of Jack's photographs. And the descriptions of each of those photographs Jack has provided for us. These are photographs that Jack has taken. And since a lot of the information is still in his brain, he is transferring that information to us so that we have a full caption on the circumstances of the image, you know, the location, the railroad, the dates, you know, the exact dates of when the photo was taken. Jack either remembers this information or he has notes that he has taken. And I'm always taking pains to make the information about every photograph just as meticulous and as verifiable and factual as possible. And Jack is helping us do that now. But when we receive his collection, of course, you know, we'll, as I said before, we will do what we can to get it organized and make it so that researchers can access it. Now, something I want to talk about, Jack, is who is using these materials? You know, I sometimes I get asked, well, you know, who cares about railroad history? Who cares about these meticulous facts about railroad trains, about, you know, how many drivers it is? And the thing I want to emphasize is that railroad history is the history of industrial America. And we do have an avid railroad researcher audience and clientele that come to the archive. They either come to do their own research in our reading room, or they contact me about their railroad research, and I will access all of the railroad collections. There are about 75 railroad collections at the UConn Archives, including Jack's photographs, which we have online. I'll access all the collections to try to answer their railroad-related questions. But Jack, how do you find that your collection is used now? You still are very avidly using your collection. You're helping other authors get photographs from your collection, or you're helping them with the history of what they're trying to write about. How would you say that you use your collection today?
Well, I get requests. There's a magazine called Railroad History, which is the Railroad and Locomotive Historical Society biannual. It's about the size of a Reader's Digest, and they come to me and tell me what articles they're doing and ask if I can help with any of them, and usually I can, and I'll put together a whole sample of these from around the world, anything for their articles, and then I'll send it to their photo editor. I'll mail the actual negatives or slides, and you know, certified mail and so on, so that I've never lost anything, and they'll scan them all, return them, and they'll use maybe a fraction of them for the articles, but this gives them plenty of material to pick from. And the railroad magazines will also ask me, they say, we're going to do something on the Union Pacific 484 type locomotive. What do you have? And because I've provided so much stuff that they know that they can come to me and usually get something. So I use it all the time. I have a bunch of it out in Canada right now. The editor's up in Canada, slides and negatives. And he's scanning them all for the next issue. And they'll come back. So it's not just static. It's just, and I never know what I'm going to use next. That's why I can't give any portion of the collection to the Yukon Archives yet, because I had something on the Alton and Southern Railroad. It was a very obscure aluminum railroad, and I never thought I'd use that. And sure enough, there's an article on that, and they're using that. So it's and again, you have to remember what you've got. Yeah, but generally, I work with it so long that there's times when I can't find something, but not very often. So
there are so many railroad topics that are being researched. So there's just a very strong community out there. You know, scholars, avocational historians who are working on articles about aspects of railroad history, and Jack's collection is so comprehensive. You know, it's pretty much the history of railroads. You know, the photographs that he's taken, the history of railroads for the last 70 years, that his collection can be used for so many different facets of research that other historians are working on. And Jack, I know that you still do quite a lot of your own writing for publications, mostly about the New Haven Railroad, but other publications. Where you're using, like, your travel photographs, like when you went to Timbuktu, you've photographed railroads in Timbuktu, which I think is extraordinary. So I just want to make it clear that these collections are vibrant. Collections like Jack's are vibrant and living and still so such a valid historical resource, and we are privileged to be able to have Jack share his expertise with us, to contribute his knowledge to our railroad history archives, to have promised us his collection upon his death. And I would like to also add that Jack has given us monetary donations to support the Railroad History Archive. So in so many ways, Jack Swanberg has been a friend of the Yukon Archives and frankly, a friend to me. I don't know how I would have worked with these railroad history collections for the past 23 years if it hadn't been for you, Jack. To have you to consult with and have you have your friendship and your help in so many areas.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you. I want to add one little correction. That Timbuktu is in Mali. Mali has some railroads near Ouagadougou, but the railroad does not go to Timbuktu itself.
Oh.
but for instance, I'll write articles on these trips, too, like rode the Trans-Siberian, one of those private trains on the Trans-Siberian years ago. And I told the editor of the train magazine, well, it was a great trip. And he says, well, write it up. So I had pictures that I had taken all the way along, and I got a history of the Trans-Siberian, checked that out. And they ran a huge article on that. But that started with the railroad. And again, that was one of these private trains, not a railroad buff train, it was a rolling hotel. Took 2 weeks to make that trip, Vladivostok to Moscow, which usually takes 7 days on the regular train. But you stop in Novosibirsk, places like that, get a city tour and so on. Again, the train just waits for you. So, and I've done articles on the private train in Sicily and India and so on. So it's not just New Haven Railroad.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I had one question I wanted to ask Jack about the tools that you've used to do your own photographing. Can you talk a little bit about the cameras that you've used over the course of your documentation? You know, when did you switch from film to digital? When did you do that, et cetera?
Well, I started with an old Bellows camera of my mother's, but that wouldn't stop an action. It didn't have a fast shutter speed, so it was you could only take a still photo. Then my dad got me a 35-millimeter camera for Christmas one year when I was about 14. And, of course, that you could stop the action and so on. And so I had a series of 35-millimeter better cameras. The old ones had f3.5 lens, and the film was slow and so on, and that all kept improving. And then I switched to a press camera that took a larger negative, make a bigger enlargement and so on. And meanwhile, I stayed with 35-millimeter for color slides, which I generally use Kodachrome, which is not even made anymore. But the color slides, a lot of the magazines want color now. And the old stuff, you're not going to get color. But anything from the, say, 60s on, I have plenty of color of that. So I stayed with 35-millimeter cameras for slides, and I switched to what they call medium format, which is a 120 size negative for black and white. And then about 5 years ago, I switched to digital. I never thought I would, but I took this picture of a train up at Middlefield, and I emailed it to the editor of the train magazine. They used it for a double page spread in color. I said, well, if this thing was good enough for a double page spread, I don't need my 35-millimeter camera anymore. So, and you get instant results instead of waiting for 2 weeks when it comes back from Kodak being processed and so on. So I've completely abandoned film cameras now.
And Jack, you did a lot of your own darkroom work.
Yes, I had a darkroom for years, and until I moved to my present house in Guilford. I had one in Brantford for years, and I did a lot of the photos in that. My book were low negatives, and then I printed them for these. And you could really make a difference in a darkroom if you have an area that's a little too dark. You can what they call dodge it, give it less light, and then that makes it lighter in the print. Or if it's too washed out, you can burn in one section. There's an art to it. It's really an art to dark. It's really enjoyable. But I haven't done that now for 17 years. But it was very enjoyable, and you could really improve even a poor negative and make it pretty good.
Were you printing 120 at home as well?
The 120 negatives. I had a large enlarger that would take up to 4x5, and if I had bigger than that, you'd have to make a contact print, which is difficult because then you can't see to dodge and burn in. But usually nothing's much bigger than 4x5, and then you can work with it. So it's very enjoyable. I miss it.
My last question is kind of from a technical standpoint. So is there kind of like a method in which railroad photographers take images of very fast moving objects? Do you set your tripod up in a certain way? Kind of, can you walk us through how you would go about positioning to begin a shot, the one shot or the multiple shots that you're trying to get?
Well, there's a series of types of shots. In other words, the traditional action shot of a train is what they call a wedge. It's three-quarter view of the train of the engine with the train disappearing, getting smaller in the distance. That's called a wedge action shot. That is your standard action shot. It's not very creative, but that's what I used to always take. But then there were some creative photographers, such as Philip Hastings and Richard Steinheimer, people like that, that came up with different angles. They put people in them. They saw the agent operator handing up orders to the train, all this stuff that never occurred to me. And I realized that my photography was not very creative. So now I try and emulate, I'm not as good as they are, but I try and emulate that, although I don't take that many train pictures now anyway, because I live on the Northeast Corridor. There's really no variety. Unless I'm overseas. When I was in India, then I took a bunch of photos, but I don't carry the camera around like I used to.
Well, thank you both for such a fascinating interview. Jack, specifically, thanks for coming and being a guest here at the station at UConn, and for being a friend of the archives, as Laura has illuminated. Laura, thanks for taking over the reins on this episode, and hope everybody enjoys the show, and we'll catch you next time. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.